Hello and welcome to this week's TES podcast. I'm reporter Dave Speck, and joining me is the usual news team. We've got news editor Will Stewart. Hi, Will.
Hello.
Our deputy news editor Mary Louise Clues. Hi, Mary Louise.
Hi there.
We've got reporter John Roberts. John, hi.
Hello there.
Got reporters Catherine Love. Hi, Catherine.
Hello. Hi.
And Amy Gibbons. Hi, Amy.
Hello.
Now, it was great to speak to the new Children's Commissioner this week, Rachel D'Souza, who's a former head teacher and chief executive of a multi-academy trust. And she's carrying out the biggest ever consultation in England of children. And she was very keen to talk about that. But I also managed to have a quick chat with her about off-rolling, given that her trust was at the centre of an off-rolling row last year. And John, the stories that you wrote there about the Inspiration Trust in Norfolk, they seem to be a lot more relevant now. They've sort of come alive again. It was Ofsted that found evidence of off-rolling there, wasn't it? Is that right?
We had a couple of stories of this back in 2019. So off-rolling was really, I think, one of the big issues in education before the COVID crisis. And what we had was Ofsted went into one of the schools run by Inspiration Trust under Dame Rachel D'Souza's leadership and basically raised concerns about the way pupils have been taken off roll. Students who went into an alternative provision then dropped off the school roll, and the school couldn't explain why that was in their interest. That is basically Ofsted's definition of off-rolling, but the report stopped short of calling it off-rolling when it had found similar things were off-rolling elsewhere. Anyway, we then did a bit of digging and got inspection notes where the inspector actually said off-rolling was taking place at the school. And if I think back to December of last year, Rachel D'Souza was kind of grilled by, I think it was a story Catherine did, by MPs about this and kind of defended the trust's role. But it seems like her comments now and the kind of the criticism the trust faced then, basically there's a big gap, I think, between the two. And it's really, really, really interesting piece that you did with her kind of perspective now as the incoming Children's Commissioner.
Well, what she said, of course, was that she wants to end off-rolling, and that her experience of dealing with off-rolling and exclusions in her own trust, which she said took a couple of years to sort out, you know, that puts her in a good position to work with other people in the profession to end it elsewhere. That's what she said to us on Monday. But I'll tell you what else she said. I managed to squeeze in a question about Ofsted, and I asked her whether she thought Ofsted should continue in the same guise after the pandemic. And she said there needs to be a change of culture, which doesn't feel that surprising, John. I'll ask you this, because I know you wrote some stories a couple of years back where she came out quite strongly against Ofsted's framework.
She was one of a group of her teachers that criticised Ofsted's new framework. So again, sort of going back to just before the crisis, Ofsted brought in this curriculum-focused framework that looked less at performance data. And I think some trusts with a track record for strong school performance basically took umbrage at the way Ofsted were doing it and kind of described it as a middle-class framework, said that they were working in turning around schools in challenging circumstances and that, you know, results were still all important. And she was one of the sort of high-profile multi-academy trust leaders who spoke out in that vein. So she has been willing to criticise the inspectorate publicly before. I think, just reading that interview, what struck me, I think, is just how obviously her perspective and her focus is so different now as Children's Commissioner with a national role, national responsibility, as before as a kind of a, I don't know whether you might say celebrated school leader, controversial school leader, with a, it was on kind of one side of an approach to school improvement and seen as a kind of a map that was very much favoured by the DfE, but one that, as we've touched on, had faced controversy about allegations of off-rolling and exclusion. And it's just striking, I think. I don't know, perhaps some people might have expected her to be more sympathetic to the base which she was a part of, but it seems like she's looking at it from a much more national perspective. That's what I'd say was my kind of take on it, really.
Most of the reaction, I found the reaction quite interesting. I didn't see much reaction from people who might have been on the, you know, we need to exclude side of the debate. Because it was kind of what she said about exclusions was the most controversial thing, wasn't it? I think more than off-rolling. Because there aren't very many people that would stand up and say, you should have no exclusions at all. So it feels like she's moved from, well, I don't know. I don't know how vociferous she was in actually defending exclusions, but certainly if you look at the record of some of the schools, you've seen some move from one side of the debate to the other. But it wasn't so much her allies that were her former allies that were reacting. It was people on the kind of anti-exclusion, and there seemed to be a mix between people going, "Brilliant, Carl, it's so good to hear you saying this," and then there was a fair bit of cynicism as well, wasn't it? People saying, "You know, why would somebody change their mind on this so quickly?" Yeah,
yeah. Of course, Dr. Alex George came out against exclusions the following day, didn't he? The former doctor on Love Island, who was speaking at the Ed Select Committee. So we had quite a lot of opposition this week to exclusion. But let me move on, because GCSEs, one of our favourite subjects. Lots of stories yesterday about GCSEs. And in particular, grade inflation. There were two senior figures in Ofqual yesterday speaking about grade inflation. Simon Leibus, the chief regulator, told the ASCL conference that there'd only be a small upward pressure on outcomes rather than on the scale of the Weimar Republic in 1920s Germany. Catherine, was he playing it down? How did you take this? Because you reported this, didn't you?
So it was reported on by both me and John.
Oh, sorry, yeah.
I think what was interesting in that was that both Simon Leibus and Ian Balcombe used like a very similar example for why there might be this year with teacher assessment a kind of inbuilt inflation in the system.
And I should say that Ian Balcombe was speaking at ASCL as well yesterday, also about grade inflation. He's the Ofqual chair. Sorry to interrupt you, but yeah, carry on. Sorry.
And I think they both used this example, which is exactly why, if you use teacher assessment, that there would be some inbuilt inflation compared to a year where students might take exams, which is essentially that if you've got a class of 30, you might know that five students are working at a grade 9 or, you know, you might know that, you know, 10 students are working at a grade 6, but you know that kind of from their work through the year, that's kind of where they've been. And obviously, if they sit an exam, students can have a bad day, or equally, they can have a good day, but they can have a day where actually their final result is a bit unexpected for the teacher. Obviously, if you don't have exams running, then it has to be kind of based on what sort of grade they've been working at throughout the year. And that generally will lead to a bit of inflation, because all of those five students who could potentially get a grade 9, you know, they probably won't all get that on the day.
Well, the teacher will say that they will in their assessment.
Yeah, exactly that. But it's interesting because they both used that very similar example of the kind of five grade 9 students in a class, but came to quite different conclusions.
Because, John, can I just turn to you, John, and ask you what Ian Bauman said? Because he seemed to go a bit further, didn't he, in talking about something about the likely rise this year in grades is not going to be sustainable and could possibly erode the confidence in exams if it happened in the future.
Get carried on, yeah, absolutely. So as Catherine says, I mean, we often say reading from the same script, but in this case, it looked like they literally were, because they were the things they said were almost exactly the same. So they've obviously got this scenario, which on the one hand is kind of, I think, designed to explain how teachers can act in good faith and do everything right, but we'll still end up with grades much better than if they all sat exams. So on the one hand, they were saying that, but then he turned to basically say that, so he said, does that make these qualifications less valuable? No. Can it happen again? And can it keep happening? No. And I think he said, as you say, it would erode the confidence of the qualification if we see these qualifications year on year, increases year on year. And he said that might need to be controlled, but the only way you can control it is when we get back to exams. So I suppose the question that stems from it is what happens next year, I guess, and what will COVID look like? But I suppose it's also trying to allay people's concerns that grade inflation isn't coming back. It might have been a feature, an inevitable feature of the kind of COVID era of assessment. But when we can get back to exams, they were kind of making the case that they would want the same checks and balances they have that keeps grade profile steady there. But it is quite striking that on the one hand, you've got one senior figure seeking to downplay the impact of grade inflation and another sort of saying in the long term, this can't carry on. Yeah.
They were rolling the pitch, really, weren't they? They were just getting everybody ready for what's to come. I mean, there's going to be massive grade inflation, but I think it's a fair argument they made, though. I mean, it does make sense, doesn't it?
Definitely. The other thing that struck me just very quickly is just how much they, it feels like they're, what happened in 2020 is very much on their mind. So they're very much kind of setting out what's going to happen, why it's going to happen, the limitations of everything. It feels like almost like a football manager expects sort of managing expectations. Do you know what I mean? They're kind of ahead of this is why things won't be perfect and why. And also, I think inevitably laying everything on teachers in a way, because they said the reason this is going to be better than last year is that there's human judgment at the heart of it. But that is a kind of a de facto way of saying if you don't like it, it's because you don't like what the teacher decided.
It's never ahead of local elections, isn't it? Manager, but yeah.
John, I thought it was interesting that in a separate story you did, I think it was you as well, Catherine, and Ian Balcombe saying that grades or evidence to support the grades are not negotiable with pupils or parents. But I was kind of thinking that's going to be tough, isn't it? You know, in kind of smaller schools, smaller communities where, you know, teachers and parents kind of rub shoulders more and they're more part of the same community. It's going to be difficult, isn't it? It's going to be difficult anyway to not be influenced if you're a teacher.
Yeah, I mean, it's such an invidious position. I think because it's this thing where students can know what evidence they used, but not have a say in that. And you can well imagine a scenario whereby someone might think that their best work hasn't been taken into account. And yeah, I suppose Ofcom were just trying to provide cover for teachers because they were quite, the language that Ian Balcombe used was quite, let me be crystal clear, this isn't up for negotiation. People with vested interest shouldn't have a say. But, you know, people with vested interest makes it sound quite sort of sinister. But ultimately, what parent isn't going to want to try and argue the case for their kid, you know, like, so it's difficult. It's not as kind of, I don't know, sinister is probably the wrong word, but you know what I mean? It made it sound like teachers are going to face unpleasant pressures, but it is a difficult situation and I don't envy teachers at all. And I think the other thing, you know, they said guidance is coming on exactly how they're going to do this, but at the moment teachers don't exactly know how to do it. So there's all that pressure coming along with a bit of uncertainty still in the system.
Yeah, huge pressure. Catherine, can I just ask you about this story on catch-up that you've written today? Forgive me because I haven't properly read it, but am I right in thinking that some students have missed so much schooling that it's hard to give them any grade at all?
So that was, that was actually said a little while ago, earlier this month. But the story comes from the same board, so it comes from OCR. And they have done, and they did sort of stress that it's not representative because they asked 311 schools to give estimates of how much learning time over their academic courses year 11 and 13 have lost. They also did it for year 10 and 12 as well. And so we found that 96 of those schools, which is almost a third of that number, said that 51 to 100% of learning time had been lost. And earlier this month at the Westminster Education Forum, the chief executive, Jill Duffy, did make that point that for some students, you know, obviously teachers will be assessing them, but there will be, and she did say it was a minority, but there will be a minority of students where they've lost so much learning time. It will be, you know, the evidence to give them a grade just won't be there. And she said, you know, that there needs to be a public debate about that, how we support those students for going on to their next course of education and kind of supporting progression. So it is, yeah, it was quite kind of troubling that, you know, those are quite high in terms of it's not representative, but that kind of snapshot of that number of schools and then the proportion of those saying, well, actually our kids haven't been in for this amount of time, they've lost this much time. It does sort of show that when teachers making these judgments, you know, they will have to factor in exactly how many lessons have been missed.
Just yet another problem for teachers this year in the exams, isn't it? Amy, can I, very quiet today, Amy, can I bring you into this? Because you've got a splash on our website this morning about these missing pupil premium millions. I know you've been doing some really hard work on this investigation. Just bring us up to speed, would you, as to where we are, what the latest on it is.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's a fairly kind of complicated issue, but it's something the government's definitely found itself in some hot water about over the past couple of weeks. So basically, they're changing the way that people premium money is allocated this year. So instead of basing the amount of money allocated on the number of kids eligible in January, according to the census done then, they're going to base it on the census back in October, which has sparked some concerns. And certainly we found legitimate concerns that the number of pupils may well have gone up substantially in between those 2 days, especially due to the kind of the disruption caused by the COVID crisis to sort of parents' jobs and kind of the stability within the families. So that's going to be a huge issue, you know, if those pupils don't end up with the funding that they need. So the government's being urged basically to, we've tried to get them to tell us how much schools are going to lose out on because of this change. So to quantify that for us. And we're not getting any answers on it.
What a complicated thing to work out, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I mean, what they can do is they can find out how many students became eligible during that period between October and January, and then work out how much money they would have been eligible for, and therefore what that funding gap is.
I know some local authorities have already come back to you with a figure, haven't they?
Yeah, so, I mean, in the absence of any national figure, ideally we want this figure from the government to show us the size of the funding gap. But in the absence of that, we've been to local authorities to try and gauge what those numbers might be. And we've had a few come back. Some are estimating funding gaps of more than £800,000, which is obviously substantial. We had about 14 councils come back to us in total with figures that we could use. Together they show a combined loss of more than £6 million. And that doesn't even include a £3.5 million gap that had been identified previously. So it is in the multi-millions, but at the moment it's difficult to quantify. And that is causing a lot of frustration among people in the sector. For example, Mary Bowstead, who's head of the NEU Teaching Union, she said the government really need to come clean on this because she says they must know how much they were set to save from the change. And it's important that they are transparent about that. So, yeah, it's frustrating in lots of ways. We're getting early indications of what this might mean for local authorities. But in the absence of that national figure, it is just difficult to quantify at this stage.
Do you think there's a legitimate reason for making this change other than just saving some money?
Well, so the government have, you know, the reason that they've given for it is they say that it allows schools to know their budget earlier in the year. So this is using the October census rather than the January one, helping them to plan ahead. So it's the thinking behind it, well, from the DfE's point of view that, you know, that they're kind of willing to talk to us about is to make that process easier, to give them a bit more planning time and help with sort of the logistics of it, I suppose. But it has been suggested by lots of different people that this will save them some money as well.
Do schools see that as a benefit? Do they take that on at all? You know, that it does help them? Or, I mean, is there like a way that you could have done that and then not losing out on the money?
Yeah, I'm not too sure. I mean, when ASCOL, the Association of School and College Leaders, they came back to us saying that they think the DfE is reluctant to provide a figure because actually it will be substantial. But they also said at the same time, the logic behind bringing the pupil premium in line with most other, so it'll bring it in line with most other school funding. That's part of what will make it helpful. And they said the decision to proceed with it during the most disruptive period, education has seen for some time is difficult to fathom. So they think it's bad timing to make the change now, but the change itself heads, they don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. It's just not great given the circumstances we're in at the moment.
That was what one of the local authorities said, wasn't it? The quotes that stood out, they described it. Timing is spectacularly bad, I think, wasn't it?
Spectacularly bad, that's right, yeah. So you can kind of get a sense of some of the frustration there.
Well, is there a glimmer of hope that we can enter the weekend on, among all this this controversy? And I think, Mary Louise, you might be a good person to turn to here. Is there something about a dance or something about a robot? Or are you a robot or a Macarena? Sorry, I'm not in the loop. Tell us. Talk to us.
I think this is this is the great story that Amy did about following on from discussion on social media between teachers about what sort of dance move would best describe their teaching style. And there were some interesting results, wasn't there, Amy? Did you what ones jumped out at you? Ones jumped out at me was hip hop, and I thought, hang on a minute, have we got some breakdancing teachers out there? That I'd like to see that. What about you?
That would be entertaining, wouldn't it? Yeah, it was a really fun story to write. Loads of fun suggestions. We had flamenco. I like particularly the fun thing about this story was like people gave suggestions and then they explained why they thought that and have summed them up as a teacher. This person said, strong, captivating, structured with a spontaneous ole thrown in, which I thought was quite fun. And then we also had, we had the Macarena, which Dave mentioned, the robot, apparently methodical yet fun, organised yet engaging, simple yet significant. So
I liked your little summaries as well, and kind of what Tez saw, what we thought in terms of the time warp, perfect for science fiction lessons. Good one.
Yeah, I was pretty pleased with that line actually. Thanks for. Yeah, so that was the time warp. I thought that was a good suggestion as well. And they said it follows the rules, but it's still a bit crazy. So yeah, it's well worth a little read. And lots of people actually, when they responded, because it was all on Twitter, they like included little GIFs and pictures of the dancers, which I quite enjoyed as well.
Brilliant. Well, thanks for listening, and see you soon. Bye.
See you soon.
Thanks a lot. Bye.